Новые перестановки в Министерстве обороны. Сегодня
Владимир Путин... очевидно, ждут масштабные кадровые перетряски.
Ну, а главная политическая новость недели, безусловно, смена руководства министерства тянет за
собой. One of the hallmarks of Владимир Путин's rule has been stability of cadres. His people, his top ministers, members of his inner circle were untouchable. The law, to quote a popular refrain from the opposition, was only for his enemies. But with the sacking of Defense Minister Anatoly Siderikov earlier this month over a defense procurement corruption scandal, this appears to have changed. Suddenly, it appears that nobody is untouchable. The Russian media has been filled with speculation that a major government shakeup is in the works, that Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev may be sacked, that a general cleansing of the ruling elite under the guise of a war on corruption is in the offing. Is a purge on the way for Team Putin? And if so, to what ends? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert in Russia's security services, author of numerous books on Russia, and of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi there.
If a government shakeup, or more broadly, a purge of the elite, is indeed in the works, and that's still a big if at this point, there are various theories out there about why this may be the case. They range from a perceived need to pursue economic reforms with a fresh team on one hand, to a sense that Putin has become paranoid and doesn't trust his own entourage anymore on the other. Mark, let's get the ball rolling with you. Why would Putin want, assuming Putin wants to shake things up at this point, why would he want to shake things up at this point? Would this be an indication that he wants to change political course?
It could be. I mean, yes, as you say, this is very much an if. But if he's going to have some kind of a shake-up, really there's two main reasons why he'd be doing it. One is policy. That precisely he wants there to be a new course, he feels that there have to be new ideas, or, given some of the names that are floating around, old ideas brought back. But nonetheless, there has to be a policy shift. The second reason would be essentially that this is political. After all, it's not fun to be seen as faintly irrelevant. It's not fun to have people discussing your health issues in public as if you're a mere fallible mortal. Often the temptation is for a leader to therefore assert himself by showing that he is indeed the one unchanging point, that he can throw out a government and bring in new people who are then beholden to him and therefore have to say the right things. But above all, that he's asserting his power to the elite, and he's demonstrating his power to the masses.
Do you think the policy and the politics thing are mutually exclusive? I mean, it could be both at the same time, could it not?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if you're having a major reshuffle to change policy, then you're also asserting your power. It's more that the other way around. You can just simply end up just reshuffling the pack and bringing the same cards into play without really changing ideas.
And we're probably going to get a good idea by the end of the year, because the Kremlin announced last week that Putin's working on an address to parliament that he's most likely going to deliver sometime in December. Peskov announced that back last week. Kirill, is there anything you want to add to this?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with Mark about the lack of fresh ideas in Putin's entourage and in Putin's mind. If you don't have any, you know, new ideas and so on, how to govern or how to rule the country, how to run the country, so you are beginning to shake your entourage, your cabinet, and whatever. Secondly, it's very interesting example of post-Soviet, like Soviet leaders in the so-called кадры, аппаратчики, and номенклатура. Номенклатура.
Номенклатура.
Кадры решают все. So they believe, they really believe that if they change, you know, for instance, defense minister, everything will be perfect about the reforms in the army, about the corruption and so on. And the answer of, common sense is no, it couldn't be, it wouldn't be, it shouldn't be, because if you want to make some reforms, if you want really change your country, if you want to change your course, by the way, You need not just new people, fresh people and so on. You need some ideas and some images of the future. What is your aim? What is the image? Not just the idea of your aim to be better, to be, you know, stronger, to be wealthy and so on, but the image, the shape of this future.
Well, that's a good way to segue now, because let's for now zero in on one of the names that's been coming up, and I think we all know whose name that is. It's the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, who, and there's a lot of things converging right now around Kudrin that make me think he may be somebody to watch. Number one, if we remember correctly, the stated reason that Kudrin resigned and turned against the government back in September of 2011 was the increase in defense spending that Serdyukov pushed through, Putin objected to,
yes,
but he got Medvedev to agree to it, right? And so removing Serdyukov in many ways could be the beginning of a process of bringing Kudrin back in. Now, Kirill, you talked about ideas. Kudrin certainly has ideas. Ideas about the economy, and ideas about the political system. He believes that there has to be market reform, greater market reforms. He believes the economy needs to be diversified away from energy. He believes that political reform has to accompany market reforms. But paradoxically, he's also very, very close personally to Putin. Putin trusts him. He's reputedly the only person in the elite allowed to use the familiar T form with Putin in private conversations. Mark, what do you think? Do you see now? Somebody's going to have to compromise if in the event of Kudrin coming back, because he's either going to have to abandon some of his stated principles, or Putin's going to have to give in on political reform, or is there another way?
To be honest, I don't think there is an easy way of squaring that circle. It precisely sort of, in some ways, I think Kudrin maybe deliberately, maybe inadvertently, has painted himself into a position in which there's a limit to how much compromise he could do and go into the government and remain credible. And we know that, you know, Kudrin is a strong figure. He's got a strong character, and he does have real beliefs and views. I mean, this is, you know, going back to Kirill's point about it, you know, that you need to present images of the future, which I think is absolutely right. Images of the future is like strategy. It's one of these things that historically Putin outsources. He finds someone else to provide that as he sort of concentrates on managing the elite and so forth. And the thing about Kudrin is that it's increasingly impossible, I would say, that's not too much of a contradiction in terms, to be able to reconcile not just the defense budget, but a lot of associated and ancillary costs which are around that. Because remember, the Russians spend a lot more on the military than just is visible in the defense budget. And Kudrin knows that full well. In order to diversify, not only does it mean actually moving money away from the defense sector, it also means a whole variety of changes which are frankly antithetical to that sector. It means less subsidies, keeping factories that have no economic viability afloat, less money being spent in essentially providing export credits so that you quote-unquote export arms, but in practice the recipient is paying them with IOUs that you're backing, as a means of international soft power. There's a whole variety of ways that all this nests together. And therefore, I think there is going to have to be some kind of a showdown between, you know, obviously mediated and ultimately decided by Putin, between Kudrin and the economic liberals, mm-hmm, who want to create market reforms, and the classic Silovik interests, but particularly the, you know, defense industrial complex. I think that there's going to have to be some kind of strong resolution there.
And I would add to your point that the very idea of diversification means reducing the importance of the energy sector, which the Siloviki are heavily invested in. Now, on the other hand, this might be a political masterstroke for Putin for one reason. If you brought Kudrin in, it has the potential to divide the opposition even more than it's already divided, because Kudrin is revered by the urban professional component of the opposition, although he's reviled by the left of the left wing of the opposition. Well, what about that, Kirill?
I'm sitting and thinking about what we are doing just now, discussing all these issues, we're destroying the myth or delusion about, struggle of liberal Medvedev entourage or group against autocrat Putin group.
Because it was always a myth.
Yes, that was the myth, and one of the best examples of this is Serdyukov himself. Because Serdyukov is from Medvedev's entourage, and he is absolutely sure, corrupted. Mm-hmm. And his group is full of corrupted, bureaucrats and so on. And at the same time, Kudrin, who is fighting against all this, spree, finance spree on military and so on, he is a Putin's man. So we don't see a struggle between, liberals, Medvedev liberals or whatever, against Putin autocrats and Siloviki. This is a split between the groups which could not be defined ideologically. That is my main point. That's not about ideology, because all these problems around, new strategy, Putin strategy, but I believe that there is no any new strategy, and so on. There are two levels. First of all, is pragmatic. Austerity against investment and spending, yes, it's very interesting that is the Western problem. It's not Russian problem itself. Mm-hmm. It's just two models of modern.
It's a universal.
Yes,
problem.
Universal problem. Yes, but it's interesting that it's universal problem just from 2008, not before this. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the struggle of austerity against spending. It was There were two models, Keynesian and mm-hmm. neoliberal models, but
Friedman.
Yes, Friedman, whatever. And the second level is ideological. Democracy against, autocracy and so on. So there are two levels of the problem, and we can define two or three or four groups inside Kremlin which are struggling against each other in ideological terms. That is my point.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that bringing Kudrin in, and this is all speculation at this point, but I think it's informed speculation, bringing Kudrin in could indeed split the opposition, because the urban professional component of the opposition likes Kudrin. While the left, which seems to be what the Kremlin really fears, given the case against Udaltsov, doesn't like Kudrin, and this could kind of split the opposition in two.
I am very risky to be like Udaltsov or to sound like Udaltsov, but I think that liberal opposition will love everyone except Putin. Everyone. They personally hate Putin. It's not about, ideology and so on. This is a personal feeling of, disgust. They disgust him. And Kudrin, as with his background and his, all these Western manners and so on, Kudrin, who is not speaking that Pussy Riot, they are anti-Semitic girls and so on. So, of course, everyone in this role will will fit all their expectations, and it's not about Kudrin himself. We don't know if Kudrin is liberal. We don't
economically
know. Economically, yes, and that is the pragmatic level.
And judging from his statements, at least since September of 2011, I would say for 2010, 2011, he was talking to. In fairness to Kudrin, he was talking about the need for political pluralism throughout much of the Medvedev presidency. But in his statements, he served the Putin regime for a long time when it was anything but liberal. During the Medvedev presidency, he came out and started to say, if you're going to have true economic reform, you have to have political reform along with it. I've often argued that the true tandem in Russia, even during the Medvedev presidency, is Putin and Kudrin, not Putin and Medvedev. That these two represent the kind of the two wings of what Gleb Pavlovsky used to call the Putin majority that doesn't really exist anymore. So, Mark, what about, I mean, would bringing Kudrin back in potentially put that Putin majority back together, put that coalition, that governing coalition that Putin used to have back together? And again, at what cost? Because Kudrin would not be a technical prime minister. He would be a very real and very powerful prime minister.
Well, that can be addressed really on several levels. I mean, first of all, let's just quickly touch on this notion that Kudrin would therefore split the opposition. I agree with you if the opposition is essentially regarded in terms of a group of people. But let's face it, the opposition is still a very marginal force. Arguably, the opposition, quote-unquote, is a conceptual issue. It's actually people getting fed up, people getting tired with the current direction of policy, people getting tired with the sense that there is not, you know, there aren't working mechanisms for alternatives in Russia. So on the one hand, ironically, bringing in Kudrin might well please a lot of these people, but on the other hand, could well also be regarded as a victory. Could well also actually be seen as Putin having to, surrender is the wrong word, but certainly make concessions to those demanding change. So actually it could well hearten them as well. But going into this business of whether or not then the real tandem comes together, I think this speaks to something that Putin fails to understand. In some ways, Putin is a product of his first term, when he had the money, he had the legitimacy, everything was going his way. Now there are going to be some hard decisions to be made. And I think, yes, Kudrin's economic liberalism carries with it an implicit political liberalism. I mean, we shouldn't create too much of a myth of Kudrin as the prince across the water who will make everything better. I mean, ultimately, Kudrin is above all the friend of international banks, not Russian masses. But nonetheless, if you're going to have a working liberal economy, that brings with it all kinds of other things that will actually begin to liberalize the political system. You need to have less political control of the economy. You need to have less scope for raiding and the constant plundering if you want people to invest. You need to have companies that can operate on international marketplaces with international levels of transparency. And you also need to have a new generation of managers and specialists and scientists and innovators who are willing to stay in Russia rather than get whatever job they can get outside of the country. So it's not as if Kudrin necessarily is coming in with, I would say, a politically liberal concept. But nonetheless, I would say that I think that actually Kudrin's economically liberal concept implicitly will bring political changes. And I'm not sure that Putin fully understands that. And so in some ways, I think this is still going to be the biggest tension within the new tandem.
I actually speculated this very thing on the blog today. This may indeed be Kudrin's calculus, that he will compromise in the short term, come in, implement his liberal economic program, knowing full well that over time, if you decentralize an economy that's centered on commodities, if you diversify and decentralize that, over time it's going to create different economic centers of power and ultimately different political centers of power, and that he will win in the long term. That may indeed be his calculus, but you're right, there's going to be a lot of tensions in the short term. Kirill, anything you want to add?
It sounds pretty Marxist that economic changes will lead or should lead to some political changes. In this game, I'll play, a postmodernist role, and I can say that maybe the changes in ideology, in the words, will change the situation in politics and economy. For instance, Mark told, and I absolutely agree with him, that opposition in Russia is not just one group. It's not a group at all. It's not a group of people. Opposition in Russia, it's a quiet, sometimes quiet, popular feeling, public feeling. It's a feeling. It's not a group of people. It's not political party and so on. And this feeling is spreading widely all over Russia. And I just, 2 weeks ago, I returned from Russia and I had a lot of conversation with various people, so-called ordinary people, yes, of course. And most of them told that they're very unhappy with the situation in Russia in various aspects, national aspects. Of course, there are a lot of people with whom I spoke to. They have strong nationalist feelings and so on. Some of them, they're unhappy of the economic course, and they're communists and leftists. Some of them are very unhappy, a lot of them, or maybe most of them, unhappy with corruption all over the country and so on. So that is not just the source of Russian opposition. That is Russian opposition today, as it is. So group of people whom we define as an opposition now in Russia is not the most powerful part of, you know, all this structure.
Which you mean the latent discontent that was widespread in the country.
And all this idea with Kudrin as a head of leader of liberals who can, you know, split the opposition and lead the opposition liberals and so on.
Well, no, my point with Kudrin is that he could, as Mark pointed out, his appointment would be cheered by the urban professional component of those who are unhappy with the regime right now. It might bring those people more back onto the side, back into the Putin coalition, if you will. That's what I mean by splitting the opposition.
Yes, in some sense this is so. But anyway, when we speak about the Russian opposition, we have to have in mind that opposition is a very popular, maybe quite popular, and sometimes very popular public feeling. And when you play with all this, you know, unhappiness all around Russia and a very strong, you know, feeling not just against Putin himself, but against bureaucracy and mm-hmm. police and so on, we can discuss this way of things when, you know, some liberal economic changes will lead to some political changes. I think, and I'm absolutely sure, that there are two sources of all political changes in today Russia. First of all, it's Kremlin itself and various groups inside Kremlin. And the second source, all this public feeling about the government and about Putin. Not just some, you know, kind of liberal reforms. For instance, now we see several attempts to make reforms in education and so on.
Healthcare
and so on. In the very heart of the ideas of this reform, the very heart of the ideas of this reform is very liberal, by the way. But you can see such a strong opposition among all Russian society, all these attempts, they face all these protests and so on. For instance, today is the story about the university reforms and so on, and mm-hmm. closing the departments, philology department in St. Petersburg University mm-hmm. and so on. I'm not defending the idea to close department of philology in St. Petersburg University, but we have to focus on how much does it cost. And what is the, you know, the outcome of the very existence of such huge department of philology?
It is a very big department.
Yes. Everyone knows.
Everyone that studied the Russian language in Russia knows that department. Yes.
Yes. And I think almost everyone knows that not all in this department is very, you know, good.
Yes.
And something has to be done with this. Mm-hmm. And this is just one of the example. Yeah. So the beginning, the attempts of every so-called liberal reforms in today's Russian society will face a very strong opposition, not just from so-called opposition groups in Russia, but from ordinary people who are very far from politics at all. Mm-hmm.
There's one thing I do want to get to before we move on to the second half is this. There have been a lot of corruption cases right now. And this is what we're seeing right now is kind of the context of it all is what looks like at first glance to the untrained eye, a war on corruption. Right. In addition to the Serdyukov case with Oberon Service, you have the GLONASS case. You have this corruption scandal in the health ministry in Chelyabinsk. And it suddenly looks like there's the Kremlin is launching corruption scandals against its own people all over the place. You have documentaries on Channel One attacking not Pussy Riot or Navalny, the same moment of attacking who? The defense ministry. So what's going on here? I mean, one of the theories out there is that this, because you never can look at a corruption scandal in Russia and think it's just, a corruption campaign in Russia and think it's just a corruption campaign. They want to clean up City Hall. No, there's always some ulterior motive. And what a lot of people think might be going on here is basically a settling of scores. And Serdyukov is just the first of many people who
let's face it, we're Medvedev supporters in during the Medvedev presidency. We're pushing for a second term for Medvedev, and now they're going to have the whole anti-corruption machine turned on them because, again, let's face it, the way things work in Russia, everybody is vulnerable to corruption allegations. It's very hard to stay clean when you're in government in Russia. Mark, what do you make of that?
Well, I think there's several things going on at once. Again, it's not unusual. It's something that we've seen in Russian politics before. I mean, first of all, I think there is a genuine appreciation of the costs of corruption. You know, when you've got 20% plus of the state arms procurement budget being wasted through fraud and embezzlement, well, if you're trying to, for example, you know, work out how you can buy shiny new tanks and yet also cut the defense budget, well, that's an obvious place to go. So there's a variety of reasons why it actually makes sense. Secondly, though, politically it makes sense. I mean, this is for me, and I've long felt this, that this is one of the key vulnerability points of the Putin regime. And if the opposition really wanted to move beyond just simply being an urban and metropolitan middle-class elite movement and into the mass movement, that's the one point of similarity they have, that they actually can reach out, you know, as they have in some local elections, and actually be able to make the point that, look, you know, we have common interests, you know, poor, rich, middle class or whatever, we are all afflicted by corruption, and that is all dependent on who's in the Kremlin. So, I mean, I think potentially that's one of their rallying cries. And I think, therefore, the Kremlin is moving to co-opt that.
Which is why the Navalny slogan of the party of thieves and swindlers was so effective.
Yeah, exactly. So they can't allow that to actually take off. So that's the second reason. The third reason is, again, if we're talking about Putin wanting to reestablish his sense of control, his power over the elite, it's a wonderful weapon. Because let's face it, you know, pretty much everyone in the elite has skeletons in the closet. It's just simply a question of, you know full well that the Kremlin can decide whose closet to open and then say how shocked they are to discover evidence of corruption. So, you know, it's a good way of keeping the elite realizing that they are still dependent on the Kremlin. And when you're in that situation, I mean, the fourth reason is precisely that the whole thing then gets also sometimes hijacked for turf wars, settling of private scores and so forth. Because, you know, when you're in this environment, it's quite easy to therefore use the machinery and the apparatus and the rhetoric of an anti-corruption campaign to mask some kind of, you know, land grab.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, we'll move on to our second half. In a few moments, we'll continue this discussion, but narrow the aperture and talk about the generation of Russian elites waiting in the wings. Putin, after all, isn't getting any younger. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia security services, an author of numerous books on Russia, and of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
The reports alleging that the president is experiencing health problems do not correspond to reality. The president is working on an intensive daily schedule.
Announcements like that from a Kremlin press secretary back when I was working in Russia in the 90s were common. You know, I remember President Yeltsin is working with documents.
With documents, yes. I remember this magic
that was formula. That was Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov. I half expected him to say that President Putin is working with documents. This bit about Putin's health has been going on for a while now. Reports that he injured his back during his famous flight with the migrating white cranes raised an issue he'd probably not have discussed, that he's not getting any younger. He can't do this anymore like he was able to do it earlier in his presidency. Rumors that the fact that he canceled a bunch of foreign trips because of ill health harkens back to memories of Soviet leaders like Brezhnev and Putin's ailing successor Boris Yeltsin. Now these parallels are a little bit overstated. Putin just turned 60. But his team is aging, and if he remains in power, they're going to age together because most of them are about the same age as Putin. They all came up in the KGB together in the 70s, and they're all getting into their 60s now. And meanwhile, though, time goes on, and a younger generation is rising, waiting for their chance, and they could be waiting for a long time. Like we talked last on the podcast last week, Kirill, we talked about the Brezhnev generation, the famous class of 37 that rose up after the Stalin
classic
purges,
classic Brezhnev generation
that ruled the country for decades. But there's a younger generation that's smart. A lot of it's Western educated, and a lot of it thinks pretty soon it's going to be their turn to take their turn at the reins. Kirill, let's start with you, since you're an expert on watching Russian leaders get old. You grew up in the Brezhnev era and saw the whole thing, right? So let's start with you. It is a generational conflict on the way in Russia. Do you see this coming?
I'm happy to be an expert in aging Russian politicians, of course, yes.
Well, you are. Come on. You were born just as Brezhnev was coming to power. You were a university student when he died. I mean, you saw the whole thing.
Don't forget about
Chernyanka,
by the way.
You saw the dashing young Brezhnev. Brezhnev, yes. You saw the decrepit old, yes, Brezhnev.
And I saw Yeltsin, by the way.
Yeltsin,
yes. I just remember the times of this magic phrase that President Yeltsin is working with documents and so on. It was in 1996, 1997, and I was a great fan, so sorry for my personal memoir. I was a great fan of Britpop musical style, and I listened to British Britpop band Pulp, and Pulp sang a song, "Help the Aged." Uh-huh. I don't know if you remember the song, but you can play it in the end of the.
We'll stick with Noise MC.
Yes. So, speaking seriously, of course, Putin is aging, getting older with all the group which he brought to the power, to Kremlin, with him. But this group is now splitted, not splitted with some political struggle and so on, but just by some, first of all, natural causes, yes, of course, and secondly, there is a struggle between so-called Petersky's from some people from St. Petersburg and Moskovsky, Moskovites, and some representatives of provincial elite is participating in the struggle and so on, and the result always is a little bit unclear. Not always these Petersky's or some people from St. Petersburg are winning in the struggle, first of all. Secondly, next generation. So the question is, next generation of whom? Not just of Russians, yes, of Russian elite. Next generation of FSB agents, or next generation of businessmen, or next generation the sons and daughters of Russian oligarchs, like Alexander Lebedev the Jr.,
yes,
who is really now is an editor-in-chief of British newspaper Independent. So whom we are speaking about now?
Well, I think we can talk about it across the board. I was going to start with the elite and move into society. And one of the things Medvedev did during his presidency that could be enduring is he brought in a lot of younger people at the middle and lower levels. And that a lot of these people, a lot of the support for a Medvedev third term, not at the top, but in the bureaucracy, was from these young Turks that Medvedev brought in and that whose support he was going to count on. So there's the components of a generational split in the elite writ large. There's also a component of a split in all the aspects, all the different areas you said. Certainly security services, I think Mark will have a few things to say about that. In society, in media, it's across the board. But do you see, because I think you lived through kind of a generational shift.
Yes.
You're the only one of the three of us talking on this podcast right now that lived through a Russian generational shift that happened when the Brezhnev generation passed. Do you see anything that's catches your eye right now?
I have just two points, but they're both of them were very serious for me. First of all, when we're speaking about various groups of this new generation, don't forget about the disastrous state of higher education in Russia in 2000s. And one part of this generation, of new generation of Russian political elite, is the result of this educational system. They are graduates from Russian universities in the beginning of 2000s. So I can object against, you know, your words about that they are smarter in some sense than the previous generation. First of all. Secondly, of course, another part of new generation, they obtained education in some Western universities and school and colleges and so on. Of course, this is a westernized part of the elite. But the question is, if they want to take part in political game, maybe they just want to make money or just to enjoy life? That is the question. Who wants to be, you know, part of political struggle or political elite today in today's Russia? Who? I'm not sure that there are, you know, sons or daughters of Russian or billionaires, oligarchs or politicians.
You're saying the best and the brightest of this generation aren't going into politics?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Because, you know, in some senses, in moral sense, just they don't want to take part in this process, because objectively they're looking at all this with it's disgusting for them. They don't want to play this game, not because they are, you know, Leo Tolstoy's or Fyodor Dostoevsky's of ethics and so on. No, just they're just ordinary people who don't want to, you know, participate in this, and that's all.
Mark, what do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got to realize that the new generation have a very different sort of set of experiences and expectations. I mean, I was thinking of the security agencies, particularly, and I was thinking, well, if you're a 40-year-old FSB officer who's been in service for 20 years, you never served in the Soviet KGB. You actually joined in the post-Soviet era. So first of all, you haven't got the experience of the sort of old glories and then seeing that lost and perhaps something that you want to regain. But also, you join, your formative experiences were in that messy free-for-all, which is the 1990s. Because very much, and I mean, it's hard to know how far one can universalize, but if I look at the Silovik agencies, in the coming generation, there I see the key struggle, or the key sort of divide being between, shall we say, the entrepreneurs, people who see their job as just simply being, well, this is how I make a nice life. And maybe this simply means being a particularly sort of effective maneuverer, so you rise up the ranks quickly. Or maybe it means precisely you have little side order, or, you know, businesses, or you're just simply corrupt. But nonetheless, that essentially everything is just simply about what I'm going to make out of it. And yet there are also the professionals, the people who actually, yes, of course, they want to have a nice life, but they want to do their job well, they believe in what they're doing. And I find that being played out quite a lot in terms of, if we're talking about the majors, the lieutenant colonels, the people who are going to be the sort of the next generation of generals and division heads and eventually sort of directors. And the interesting thing is that, again, that's still much more insular. It's, well, how do we make our police service, our security service right and proper, or how do I personally make money out of it? Again, I find very little enthusiasm for the idea of engaging in politics. I don't just simply mean standing for the Duma. I mean actually thinking that the problem is solved in the Kremlin, or let alone in the Duma. It's very much still, it's that sense that the problem is solved here, in my little world, in my institution, in my office, in my service. And again, I think that's one of these interesting sort of phenomena. We're not quite sure how it's going to play out once these people do get to be the generation at the top. Is actually, do they think that the job of being a public figure is to serve in the interests of the public? Or do they think it's just simply, well, okay, this is then how I fix my little part of the world, or just simply make a lot of money?
So what I hear you saying is that this generation tends to be kind of oriented in its own little niche and has very little concept of the general of the general society and of politics in general. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, I mean, it's based on obviously a very narrow sample interpreted entirely personally, but that definitely is the feeling I get.
Kirill, do you think that can be extrapolated out to the generation writ large? Is this kind of a me generation?
When I think about this, I think that this lack of or absence of Soviet experience is the strongest and at the same time the weakest part of their identity. I can explain why. The weakest part is because they don't understand that so-called strong hand of the state mm-hmm. is not such, you know, such good for, you know, for their profession, for their business, for their, you know, whatever. So because a lot of young people, a lot of people from the fresh generation in Russia, they think about Soviet times not with it's not nostalgia because they never lived in Soviet times, but they think about Soviet times as a time when a period of life when there was no corruption, for instance. First of all,
that's funny.
Yes, that's funny because I know I have this experience. We had corruption in the Soviet Union, of course. And secondly, they can't understand that totalitarian or authoritarian state is not a perfect tool against the corruption, because killing the corruption or destroying the corruption, as it was in Stalin's times, the state at the same time is destroying just all the people or the lot of people inside the country and outside the country, mm-hmm. by the way. That's why I think that the absence of Soviet experience is weakest side or part of the identity of new generation. But at the same time, it's the strongest one because they don't have this fear. Mm. They don't use to feel fear from the state, from all the gestures of the state. And that is very important. So which side of this experience, of this absence of the Soviet experience will prevail, so we'll see in the future.
I mean, one thing before we wrap up, I also wanted to note here is something that I see in this generation is a fierce pragmatism.
It's a romantic pragmatism.
I mean, I would the person in the current ruling elite that I would identify this is Dmitry Kozak, who I often refer to as Putin's Mr. Fix-It. Whether it's the North Caucasus or what have you, you send Kozak if you got a problem you got to deal with and you got to fix. He's, according to a lot of rumors, is on tap to be potentially the next prosecutor general. Mark, do you see Kozak as the kind of the new model Russian leader?
I think he's a new model Russian leader. I think he'd be a very interesting choice for prosecutor general, given just how important that role is. But very much, I mean, to me, it's hard to see Kozak as being more than exactly a Mr. Fix-It. It's that essentially depoliticized group. I mean, I agree with Kirill. It's interesting that the new generation don't have a fear of the state. In some ways, I think what has replaced that, though, is given that these are products of the 1990s, is a fear of chaos. A sense that, in fact, the worst thing that can happen is anarchy and free-for-all, and compromises may have to be made in order to avoid that. And very much I see Kozak in that line, that actually he may be on a personal human level sort of moderate in many ways, but nonetheless he is very much a figure who thinks that the state is important and the state's interests have to be kept to the fore. But I think there are others who are much, much more self-interested, and I think we can see this division between entrepreneurs and professionals in the whole new sort of secondary generation, the Shoigus, the Ivanovs, the Rogozins, and so forth, who are in the wings potentially to be tapped for the top job or jobs. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I would actually love to continue this discussion. We're going to have to do it at another time, as I'm seeing from our producers that we have to abandon the studio. So that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian Service. And on the line from New York City has been NYU Professor Mark Galeotti, an expert on Russia security services and author of numerous books on Russia and of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you very much.
And a big thanks to our outstanding producer, Tanya Koncheva, and to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, who runs the must-follow Twitter feed Russia Police Watch. You can follow Pavel's keen insights at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.